Imagine Virginia Woolf with a passel of brats. Jane Austen, Eudora Welty, Colette, Simone de Beauvoir, Edith Wharton, Elizabeth Bishop, Willa Cather. Well, Margaret, too, so I thought. Now I'm scurrying around to find counterexamples for new role models. Sylvia Plath? We know how that ended. Joan Didion? Not ideal. Jhumpa Lahiri? Zadie Smith? She's a strong one. No others came to mind, but I'll keep thinking. My mother maintained she double-doted on me because pregnancy and birth were horrible enough that she never had the nerve to try again. Mine has been sweet, but coming up are the months when my body billows outward and I'm left just holding up a flapping flag on this ship that has set sail. Who knows? If Virginia Woolf had birthed sweet sons, maybe she wouldn't have loaded her pockets with rocks and waded into the river ooze. Our family doctor in Miami was happy to be proven wrong. He gave me good news, too. If you have a child after 40, you're 4 times more likely to live to be 100. That takes away some of the anxiety about leaving a motherless college student. Miss X may be in her mid-50s when I am swooped into the beyond. The most surprised person I encountered on our Florida trip was my first love, now friend, Jer. I had to meet with him and Stacy, the woman who rented my parents' house, because of the screen porch wood rot. Plus, I wanted to see the house. 2 window frames in my mother's room need replacing. I agreed also to paint the kitchen and put in a new dishwasher. Their rent is so low that I thought they could just do these things themselves, but no. Jer didn't notice. I was wearing a bulky cardigan and leggings. It was only when Stacy stepped out to make coffee that he asked in a pinched voice, "What's new with you?" I doubtlessly beamed and said, "I am expecting a baby in June." He almost swallowed his teeth as he restrained from asking how that could be. I answered for him. "I was shocked, too. Accident. I'm thrilled. I was blown sideways at first. As you know, I could never." His partner's girls prance in, sweet, all ponytails and flounce and mouthfuls of braces. I'm happy for him. If we come back, either they'll have to move or maybe I'll sell them the house, which is hard to imagine. It's my only major asset. What money my parents left, dwindled by my mother's long illness, I used to buy Fonte de la Folie. My parents loved every wall and footpath and keyhole of our sprawling stucco house, set back from the street and surrounded by palms and moss-hung live oaks. I told Jer that Colin has a chance to work out of Miami and that we might be spending time here. I asked him his plans. "I think we'll marry. She makes me happy, and I hope I do the same. Who wouldn't love those girls? They light up any room. You know, this house still reeks of you and your family. Sometimes I think I'm going to see you flying down the stairs with an armful of books, or your mother lying on the chaise longue in the sunroom, that pink silk throw over her legs, her head in a cloud of smoke. Your dad's workshop still has his tools all lined up on the pegboard. Anyway, I'm thinking we'll move soon. Start fresh in one of those waterfront spec houses. Hot tub and Weber. The works." He grinned, knowing my disdain for spec and tract housing. Reeks offended a bit, but I knew what he meant. I saw friends who shrieked and jumped up and down. A couple of writers from the University of Miami writing program invited me out for Cuban food. Garlic chicken equals soul food. The The chair, also a poet, asked me to teach as an adjunct any time. Good to know. Last, best, surprisingly, oh madre di Dio, we married. Why not now, we thought. I arranged everything in 2 days, and let me say, that's the best way. No stress, no huge expense, and the element of spontaneity intact. The ceremony took place in the clapboard chapel where I was baptized and where my parents married. In the end, we only had Jer and Stacy, a colleague of Collins and his partner, 3 of my high school friends, all divorced, and 6 of my parents' close friends who'd helped raise me. The Episcopal priest looked roomy and bored, but delivered the vows in a strong voice. Gladys, my mother's best friend, read a poem I requested by Jaime Sabinas. Melanie, who went off to college with me and was my roommate until she dropped out to travel with a band, merely said she'd sing a surprise song. I thought the priest would go into nuclear meltdown when she started belting out Al Green's Let's Stay Together. After, we took everyone to dinner, and that was that. Everyone toasted, reminisced, and then Melanie became the DJ, and everyone danced to I'll Be There. Colin's parents couldn't come, but sent a nice check and a set of sheets that will not fit an Italian bed. I asked Jer to store them at my mother's house. Wed we are. I wanted to keep my mother's sapphire and diamonds wedding ring, and Colin wanted me to have his grandmother's wide gold band with a single emerald. I'm laden and sparkling. I gave him my father's wedding ring, not mentioning that it had been cut off his water-swollen fingers and repaired. We had the word forever engraved inside the rings. A fearfully big word. On planes, in the condo we rented, on sleepless nights, this man I married sometimes sings in his sleep, which may be the single most endearing thing about him. I wrote, read, took notes. After absorbing Margaret's manuscript, I know that I'll not find out anything else. What I have is plenty for the book I want to write so that her work is not forgotten. The rest, the secrets I found, the complexity of her character, the sorrows and surprises, I will leave alone, except for judicious gleanings. I always thought she fell for Colin. I found out why. I thought she was jealous of me. What on earth have I done that she hasn't done better? And I found out why. Other things. She's still a cipher and will remain so. But I think maybe I've come closer to her than to anyone I've known, Colin included. And she left a paradigm novella. When I wonder what I should do, what I should write, when a moral issue arises, or even when political candidates debate. She had a clear bullshit radar. It's the Margaret in my head that I consult. What would Margaret think? Margaret would be all over that. Often there's a clear answer for me to contemplate, maybe not agree with, but there she is, compass rose, keeping me on course. Maybe everyone needs a mentor like that. Notebook. The start of a poem after reading Margaret's manuscript. I know what I know. You don't know. How can you be and not be me? But that poem of Ovid's I read during siesta about the same siesta in 8 BC. Easier than calling on a telefonino while whizzing down the autostrada, I touched old Publius Ovidius Naso. I've touched the river merchant's wife and a white rooster killed by a fox 1,300 years ago. But you're not me. And I only work here. The owner is out. No one is here to take your call. Your settings have been changed by a remote host. And if everyone lit just one little what, we could take back the light. At least. Eat more, weigh less. Lean on me. I'd know your hand in a bucket of hands. Ovid's siesta poem, or as we say, riposa, could have been written today. The river merchant's wife, Ezra Pound. The rooster, an anonymous ancient Chinese poem, I think. I've lost the reference. In the Found Stash, from Margaret's Suitcase. I became pregnant. Margaret writing, 2008, not exactly sure of the year. In January of my senior year at Georgetown. Since I was living at home, it was easy to keep my changing shape a secret, even from my father. My mother had left him 2 years ago. I elected to move home from the dorm to keep him company, to try to fill the house with activity. He adored my friends. He didn't mind waking up to find that he had to tiptoe through the living room if a couple of girls had stayed over. The father of my child sounds grandiose. He was, actually. It was a Chekhovian thing. I was in love with, let's call him Mark. He was in love with my friend, Millicent, who loved herself. Beyond that, she went from crush to crush. We were all 20, no idea what we were doing. After a party at my house one night when my father was out of town, Mark stayed after Millicent went off with a snotty law school student, a mouth breather already spotted as someone likely to go into politics. You'd recognize the name, but that's not part of my saga of getting knocked up by someone who only liked me. Mark stayed to help me clean up the glasses, ashtrays, empty pizza boxes, and then we sat in front of the fire for one of our usual talks about what Millicent wants. The talk veered into our own plans. I knew I would travel. I already was clearly on the writing path. He'd applied for law school, like many of our friends, but he lacked the ambition that marked our group. He'd always known he'd go back to Richmond to take his place in the long family line of attorneys with a vast local practice. I saw museum board meetings, historical society, portraits in the dining room, him growing stout. Not for me. But, oh really, I saw his square shoulders, face like the statue of David, the same pouty lips and serene, confident gaze as he appraises Goliath. I wanted to run my hands over his toned marble body. That I did. After we split a bottle of wine, started singing camp songs, giggling, and then he picked me up like Rhett did Scarlet and took me to my childhood bed, where we made love like crazy, 3 times. Mark fell asleep until morning. Michelangelo should have carved a sleeping David, as well as the tensile standing youth. I lay awake all night, in thrall. This was not my first time, but never had I experienced real lovemaking before. Such joy in our two bodies swirling and soaring. He would love me. My lips pressed his damp spine. Once in the night, he turned and reached for me. It was the longest night of my life, and that includes those in a concrete block hotel in Iraq with guns strafing and bombs in the streets. After amorous protestations, amorous compliments, and several cups of coffee, he was off to class. Then, nothing. I only saw him one more time, 7 weeks later. Meanwhile, Millicent reclaimed him. I dropped her as a friend. When I knew I was pregnant, I felt obligated to tell him. The father of a child. He was... Well, you've already guessed. This can't happen. Are you sure? Why didn't you... His good breeding surfaced, if only slightly. He offered to help me take care of it. Oxymoronic, I thought. He even would go with me. So long ago, dearest reader. Era of coat hangers and chemical douches, but abortions not unknown. I still can see my own stark face in the mirror as I faced impossible facts. Old story. Always new for the bearer. With my novels, there were various ways a story could work out. In life, the conclusions are few. You keep it, you give it away. And isn't it such a clue? If it were Adam or Lucinda, the conclusion veers. When Mark called the next day, I told him I had arranged the abortion. He dropped an envelope with $800 through our mail slot. Easy peasy. I turned hard against him. How could I have loved such a callous twit? I never heard from him again. I won't go into the agonies of my decision. I did not have the abortion. I dropped the group I hung out with, changed my way of dressing to loose tops, shapeless skirts, and always carried my notebooks clutched in front of me. That way, I finished the semester. In April, I confessed to my father, who dropped his glass of sherry onto his shoe. After graduation, which I did not attend, my father drove me to New York, where he'd found a studio apartment for me in the West Village. I got an unpaid internship at the Village Voice. Oddly, no one asked questions as I ballooned forth. Was I obligated to tell Mark that I was carrying the child? I thought he forfeited his right by wanting to get rid of it. I loved the work. The editors were impressed, really impressed. Later, after the baby came, they offered me a real job. I have been unbearably lonely at times. That summer was the first of my frequent bouts of intense loneliness. Estranged from my mother, who was off in a new life with an East Indian man 15 years younger, I had no one but my father to call. My other relatives would have been horrified, forever referring to me as unfortunate, as well as their previous judgments, spoiled, cheeky, too smart for her own good, and stubborn. She always was a sassy child, I once overheard. I'd drink iced tea out on the fire escape and thumb through my address book. What friend to call? But too smart for her own good. I knew this juicy piece of gossip could not possibly be kept secret. I felt like Gregor in the story, who woke up and was a bug with 6 legs and a shell. Metamorphosis, indeed. Moving from wafer thin to bulbous. Except at work, I lost my core self. It was a summer of reading Elizabeth Bowen, Henry James, I walked by his house, and Betty Friedan's book explicating The Problem with No Name. It was a summer of canned tomato soup. Roast chicken for protein, 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 and chocolate milk. I was still partly a child. I never thought that I could keep a baby, though my father offered to help me raise her or him. Not it. Through research resources at work, I found a Park Avenue adoption service and interviewed them. In glass offices, with Norfolk Island pines in pots and a wall of photos of adoptive parents gazing adoringly at little swaddled bundles in their arms, and no photos of the destroyed, bereft, or liberated birth mothers. I was shown, after an interview, folders of four couples. I lied and said I didn't know who the father was, but that he was a Georgetown student. I regretted a promiscuous period after my parents split up. I figured few adoptions took place without a few protective lies. Love lies, my mother called them. Lies you tell to protect someone, or yourself, from the truth. I stipulated well-educated, fun, loving, smart, stable. I didn't have to say not poor, because anyone paying their fee had to be well off. All four looked promising. I asked to look at others, but in the end, went back to the couple on top of the stack. She was a violinist with an open face that looked kind, straight tar black hair like Mark's. Maybe her jawline was oval like mine. She went to Colby, then Juilliard. The man was tall like Mark, with a high arched nose and eyes that looked as if he'd just delivered a witty remark. His profession intrigued me, naval architect. The father of my child. He could be. Pale, like me, probably freckled as a child, he looked stalwart and dependable. I was looking for parents who physically could have been biologically connected to the baby. The name on the folder was covered over with whiteout tape. Holding it in my lap, I deftly lifted up the tape with my nail while I chatted with the director about terms and conditions. Possibly that was my first move toward being an investigative reporter. I glanced down, smoothing my skirt. Edward and Amanda Knowles. I pressed down the tape and we worked out details. At the end of the meeting, I said, "Would you ask them to consider keeping the name I give the baby?" "That's unusual, but I will ask." "Then, thank you. The baby has a good home. Stay calm and proceed." But I was young, alone, and I pictured a wishbone. Something snapped in me. I went forward into an altered world. To make sense of the info I found in Margaret's manuscript, I copied sections in my notebook, thinking that the words running through ink onto paper would help me understand her hidden life, and why she left the sheaf of crabbed writing and typing for me to find or not. Did she somehow know she would not return? Problem with no name. Wafer thin. Writes. Judgment. Juicy gossip. Writing path. Portraits in the dining room. Run my hands. Love like crazy. Breeding. Swaddled. Pale like me. Altered world. Hideous to wake up as an insect. Ovid also wrote a Metamorphoses. My own pregnancy, opposite of hers. Mine made her story leap into life in a way it would not if I'd read this a few months after she abandoned the suitcase, when my pregnancy was beyond any possibility or even interest. Seared into my consciousness, the image of Margaret. I've seen early pictures of the young waif-like beauty and the knowing eyes. On a hot night, sitting cross-legged on the fire escape, drinking something cold, and feeling large, blank spaces around the edge of her mind. A little radio playing dance music inside. Music from a world she had to set aside. Lo studiolo. The studio. Camille looks around her painting room, noticing abruptly the transformation that has occurred. What began as an art space confined to a corner with a generous work surface, simple shelves, a reading chair, and lamp, has morphed into a humming hive of art books, museum postcards on bulletin boards, prints from museums, another work table, three easels, tubes, brushes, and stacks of paper that she makes every week with Mathilde. On new shelves, she has arranged small jars of tiny pearls, copper BBs, beads of aqua glass and faceted pewter, thin gold tesserae mosaics. How resonating the mosaics at Aquileia have proven, and minute semi-precious stones in jewel colors, a basket of antique ribbons bought at the Arezzo Antique Market, archival glues, a row of glass-tipped pens and ink bottles, lake blue, violet, burgundy, white. On one wall, where the light falls, hang her paper doors, glowing and vivid, like the Book of Kells, the illuminated manuscripts she loves in San Marco in Florence, or even Persian miniatures. She especially likes marginalia, as the monks did. She references in every historical direction, yet the paper doors are unmistakably contemporary. The designs angle and divide. She uses squares of color in patterns that could be from Moorish Spain, but for the jarring contrasts and crosshatching. 18 and counting. Each as alive to her as a person. She loves the tactile paper and the light use of ornament for a different texture and dimension. The words, lines, designs are all intuitive, though years of teaching intro to art history give her a wellspring of images. The project keeps enlarging and pulling her along, even when she'd like to stop and try to paint a winter landscape or a still life of pomegranates in a glass bowl. At Christmas, Charlie noticed. "You're putting your whole life into these," he said. And she'd made only two then. The visit opened up his own work and added a new, deepening layer to their relationship. Every few days now, one of them sends a photo and a process note. She feels closer to him than she has since he came home from college, excited about his first semester of studio art, unrolling his enormous canvases on the floor, his eyes lit with that fire she'd also felt once upon a time. Camille straightens her space, thinking not of her losses, as she has for many months, but of good fortune, a stab of happiness to have raised such a boy. A lucky love, sweet home, health, and this, all her synapses firing. Looking around her room, she whispers, not to a god, but maybe to the nun, N.M., a muse, "I'm on my way." In the kitchen, she finds Julia reading by the fireplace. She's burnished gold in the firelight, her hair pulled into a top knot and tied with blue ribbon, and the rosy throw over her lap. Hard to imagine, from the peace of this scene, her starring role in such an ugly domestic drama. Blue early evening light shimmering at the window. Yes, someone should paint this scene. Late, and Susan still works outside, taking advantage of this almost spring day. Camille watches her from the window. What's coming up? Susan already has reported that there will be major bulb action. Camille brews tea and brings the pot with biscotti over to the table in front of the fire. "Aren't you sweet," Julia says, taking two of her own hazelnut macaroons. When Susan comes in, "I want to show you both something." She drew up her feet and began to look at a magazine. "What are you reading?" "Kit's poems. They are strange." "Yes, I agree. But good strange." "Absolutely." "Where does this come from?" "We know her. She's like us. Younger, yes, but basically kind of normal. Maybe we're not. None of us, Camille joked. Really, the poems, they're the layer after you've peeled back, too. Not that I can compare with Kit, but I look at one of my paper doors, and what's there wasn't anywhere within reach before I began working. What I create comes out of the creating. Listen to this. The cat goes boneless when she sleeps, but she wakes, stretches taut. She stares out the window at birds. Her eyes dart and dart. She has no idea it's a fallen world. Goes boneless, she says, where I'd say relaxes. Then something so simple and accurate. Then, whoa, that leap out into the cosmos. It's like she touches the language with a cattle prod and shocks it into life. Is that what making art feels like to you? Must be what it feels like to her. I just get lost. Kind of a trance, if that doesn't sound too goofy. I used to love to play with my mother's tissue paper dress patterns, with all the blue lines that looked like constellation maps. I'd trace the dresses and aprons on big sheets of paper, then color them in. Remember when women wanted a sewing room? Remember paper dolls? Did you ever covet the life of Betsy McCall? McCall's magazine. Yes, I cut her little outfits out every month. Betsy has a wonderful Thanksgiving. Betsy goes to the beach. She and her mom in matching suits. I wanted to be called Betsy, not Julia. Not me. I had a doll that wet. Betsy Wetsy. But the ways my project has evolved have much to do with paper doll Betsy. And all the foreign twins paper dolls I collected. The Polish children with black rickrack, the Dutch with square faces and wooden shoes, the American Midwestern blondes in overalls and calico. Stop. Listen to us. Men would be claiming first influence from a mother playing Bach on the cello and an early encounter with Matisse's cutouts. As they talk and Camille pours more tea, Susan stamps in at the kitchen door, slipping off her gloves and out of muddy boots. Archie shakes himself, sending the cats running. We'll all be shocked in a few weeks. Bulbs are sprouting everywhere. Hyacinths. I can't tell what other kinds yet, but this garden is going to explode. Camille brings a cup for Susan. Archie, settling in front of the fire, throws his legs in the air, and two of the cats leap on him. Ragazzo jumps onto Julia's lap, ignoring the fray. Time to take note, you all. Look at this kitchen. Camille points around the room. Think of when we arrive. Now the windowsills are full of herbs and white gloxinias. There's a row of cookbooks on the mantel, Julia's jug of blue spatulas on the counter, a bowl of lemons, ceramic platters on the wall. Three cats, for Christ's sake, that rosy mohair throw, logs stacked, wine rack full. What do you think? Susan is quick to answer. We've made it home. You're right. The kitchen was gorgeous before, but now it's ours. Best kitchen I've ever cooked in. Did you know there's no Italian word for home? Only house, casa. I find that weird in a culture where home is everything. Camille continued, they don't have pet, either. Just something about animals you feed at the door. But wait, I want to bring up something. I was looking at my studio. I had not put the two images, now and then, together. I was struck. In less than 5 months, we've changed everything from when we arrived. springing forward to now. The time changes tonight, by the way. Look what we've done here. Are you as astonished as I am? Julia takes a dozen eggs out of the fridge. Okay if we have omelets and salad tonight. The cupboard is bare. We need to shop tomorrow. Yes, it's totally true. The kitchen surely smells different. From scuzzy drain and mouse to flowers and herbs, garlic and melon. You're right, Camille. I'm thinking of my room, too. All my scarves over the coverlet rack. Susan's olive tree photographs I enlarged. My desk stacked up with recipes and guidebooks. What we've all learned. Finding the faded silk draperies at the market was a stroke of luck. Oh, Danil, didn't you say, Camille? Yes, love that color. Water of the Nile. They're decadent. You make Savannah proud. And learning Italian, that's the most drastic change. Not that we're fluent by any means. I'll never get that subjunctive. They walk through the downstairs rooms, exclaiming over the changes. Into the previously blank entrance hall, Susan has dragged a round table where she keeps a grand arrangement of flowers. Here's where they leave mail and notes to each other. The top of the piano in the living room became another place for Susan's flowers. This is a morning room. Early sun floods through the windows, lighting the brick floor with blocks of light. She's kept southern-style ferns growing on the broad stone sills all winter. In the storage room upstairs, she found a tapestry showing four dainty women prancing on horses with silky manes. Somewhat tatty by now, it still looks regal over the fireplace. Who would have thought? Camille asks. I guess I expected we'd just move in, unpack, and live here as it was. A widening of the aperture, yes, but the whole panorama is a wild gift. They've done little to the dining room, where the nun's fresco so dominates that nothing else is needed except food on the table. Let's eat in here tonight. Julia opens the madia and takes out placemats and napkins. This is my favorite room. Already many memories of our feasts. Remember when Rowan gestured at the fresco and his wine glass flew across the table? Well, yes, since it landed in my lap. He recovered quickly with some wine quote from Catullus. I need to study the villa's garden scene, Cumaera, Susan says, as it was. She loves era, the big, imperfect past of was, where everything remains in motion even when finished. C'era una volta, the fairy tales begin. There was a time. Remember when a bird flew in and lighted on the table, looking at each of us, then flew back out? That was a visitation from our painter nun. Camille isn't given to flights into mysticism, but half believes this. Julia sighs and begins to grate the parmigiano as Camille and Susan fall to their usual roles, feeding the animals, setting the table, and opening the wine. Home. We are at home. We didn't know we would accomplish that. Do you have an instinct yet? Will you want to stay? Can you imagine leaving this place? Or could you go home tomorrow? We haven't been to Sicily yet. I'm just getting started. Camille thinks of the stack of handmade paper on her shelf. She misses Charlie, not Lara, and Ingrid, who sweetly took to Italy over Christmas and asks when she can come back. Isn't this better, she wonders, introducing them to this country? Better than the Sunday brunch with a bought quiche at home in North Carolina? Even the annual week at Bald Head Island? The deeper level, though, is that we remain American. Can't help that. And southern. We've all stood in a cotton field at night, lightning flashing all over the sky with electrical pylons thrumming like some music from the galaxy. Julia frowns. What? You know what I mean. In Italy, we have to live as if we belong. Susan hands around the wine. I'm fine with as if. Stay forever? I could. I miss home less than I thought, but I feel pangs for my front porch and garden every single day. It's not as though I get to see my daughters that often anyway, and I know I was repeating the years with slight variations. That's okay, nothing wrong with that. I just love waking up with a what's up today feeling, not an already know what's in store. She shows them the wild and earliest flower she found today. Aneta called it Bella Vedova. She gathered only a dozen, though they're all over the hills, mysterious, small, stalky irises of chartreuse and burgundy. Here's the first gift of spring, the beautiful widow. She picks up Archie and twirls him around. Our time here is not half up. Let's push this discussion of the future back for later. Julia says, I'll always want to have this in my life, some way or other. I love every minute here. She turns away and stares at the window running with steam. Tears. Always just out of sight, her shadow girl, now more missing than before. Whirlpool. Snake pit. She shakes back her hair. Can you believe how orange these yolks are? She whips the eggs into lemon-colored froth. How to answer, Chris? She hasn't called back since he tracked down Lizzie's last residence. She stirs in the cheese and a handful of thyme and parsley. A Jacques Pepin video taught her how to make the perfect omelette. You all ready? She maneuvers the flip and turns out the first fluffy half-moon omelette onto a plate. After dinner, Susan brings her laptop to the table. Camille and Julia moan, then laugh. When Susan does this, she's planned something. She types fast for a couple of minutes, then looks up. Want to go to Florence? Photos of a frescoed apartment appear on her screen. I found a fabulous last-minute deal. It's still available. Look at this. They see the Arno, with ochre, sienna, and russet palazzi reflecting in the water. That's the view from the living room. And I have more news. Nicola and Brian asked me to evaluate a possible rental they're considering for their portfolio. We can all go to Capri at the beginning of April. I'm afraid something awful is going to happen. We keep spinning out into wider and wider circles. Julia imagines awful. Lizzie shaking pills into the palm of her hand, gulping them down. The weeks after she left for the last time, the gut anguish that felt like drowning. What's the Italian saying? First roots, then wings? Camille, too, feels unentitled to such pleasures. She thinks of shopping, always buying her nicest clothes on sale or from catalogs. Charles liked the Land's End sweaters and shorts. She reached more toward silky prints at Off Fifth and Neiman Marcus cashmere on sale. Nonsense! Just think of all the fat cats buying up regal property in London and letting them sit empty. You think any of them worries about being smote because of a weekend in someone's luxury rental in Capri? It's a woman thing. What do we deserve? This is our easy year. We're old. We deserve some levity. Get over it. Julia and Camille love Susan for this. Florence, winter banished. Spring, near. Tufts of balmy air and the swollen river Arno running fast, toffee-colored. Few tourists, glamorous shop windows that cause you to vow to clear your closet. Enchanting palazzi with massive doors you long to open. Firenze. Julia pauses on the bridge, naming colors she sees. Cinnamon, curry, turmeric, sage. Sipping cappuccino, she lingers, smelling the turgid river, letting the morning breeze play with her hair. Looking for signs of spring, Susan spends the morning wandering in the bubbly gardens, which she finds grand and oddly depressing, parts so bleak and underplanted that she rests on a bench sketching her own version of how the park could look. Those megalomaniacal Medicis wouldn't have had such a stripped-down palette. She photographs the famous statue of the fat dwarf peeing, Neptune with a trident that looks like a big cocktail fork, and a wonderful horse rising from the water, Perseus on his back, urging him on. Walking quietly around the garden, what should be relaxing instead turns her brain into a swarm of possibilities. She finds a shady bench where she spends half an hour studying prepositions. Susan's Italian is a force of nature. She's fearless. She speaks fast. Slow, no one understands you, even if you're grammatically correct. She studied diligently all winter and frequently meets Aneta for a walk, Nicola for lunch, and Riccardo for drinks. With each, she speaks Italian the whole visit. She knows it must be painful for Riccardo. Translation is his métier. But they have good laughs at her bloopers, and often he comes home for dinner. She's learned even more by volunteering at the hospital. She only fills water glasses, helps post-surgical patients take slow steps down the hall, and sometimes, when someone asks, reads the paper aloud, much to her benefit and to the amusement of the person in bed listening. She gets corrected and remembers the next time. She's known all over the hospital for the flowers that now greet everyone in the waiting room. She glances up at Palazzo Pitti and nods. Yes. How stupid of me, she thinks. Of course, the garden design was meant to be seen from there. The perspective would be encompassing. She's a speck on the path, but the Medici clan had the godlike view without the inconvenient mud. She walks around a grand, stone-rimmed pond. If we stay at Villa Assunta, she thinks, we need water. Not a plain swimming pool, certainly no lap pool. Something natural. A local pietra serena stone surround with, what, something tall at the end with cascading water. Draw and dream, wander and look. Camille remains at the apartment, uncharacteristically blow-drying her hair into a light flip, attempting to use eyeliner and mascara, and dressing with care, even wiping every speck of dirt off her boots. She walks out in pursuit of a wild, for her, notion. At Prada, she stares in the window. She saw them yesterday. She's intimidated by the tiny, sleek woman in black who greets her at the door and stays right beside her as she tries to look around casually. Susan has explained that hovering is service, not suspicion. They're being helpful. Something, she said, we're just not used to. Camille points to the shoes she admires, covets, actually, in the window. 39? She asks. 10 minutes later, they're hers, dark red velvet shoes with a slender ankle strap and a quite high heel. Knee be damned. Now she'll have to invent an occasion to wear them. After the initial formality, seeing Camille's obvious excitement, the sales attendant became friendly and showed Camille a python skin clutch purse the same color as the shoes. She bought that, too. After her impulse purchases, she spends the morning in the vortex of American 20th century art, a just-opened exhibit of the Kandinsky-Pollock era at the Strozzi. Here's much of the art she's taught to undergrads. In this lofty setting, the synergy among the paintings hums. After months of Renaissance art, this stark return to her own time startles her. She's stopped and mesmerized by the Rothkos, five of them so wondrously lit that they seem alive from inside. She spends an hour inhaling their seeming simplicity. One looks like the surface of the moon with space behind. Really, it's just gray and white, but how luminous and grainy and opaque and mysterious. She's happy. She stares long at a Helen Frankenthaler, one of the few women represented. She loves Frankenthaler. A serious boy of perhaps 14 walks with the rented audio from painting to painting. He's intent on the Duchamps. She loved Charlie's years of awakening to art. This boy feels that quickening too. Their eyes meet for a moment and he smiles. She smiles too. A small exchange that makes her eyes sting with tears. Laughing to herself over the exuberant art, the red shoes, the boy, the promising air, she walks to Mercato Centrale, where she meets Julia and Susan for lunch. Julia spent the morning at a cooking class there, though she didn't learn much. She's long since mastered pasta making, as well as the easy panna cotta and boring tiramisu. The Mercato, a paradigm upscale food court, swarms with people even off-season. What a range! Mini shops serving hamburger, lampredotto, don't ask, truffled pasta, Sicilian pastries, divine mozzarellas. They move from counter to counter, taking little plates to a table, then visiting another enticing counter and dashing back. A good southerner, Susan opts for fried. She passes around her plate of crispy zucchini, calamari, carrots, potatoes, squash flowers, and balls of fried bread. Julia analyzes her cauliflower and guanciale pasta, a good one to remember for cold weather. Trying to move beyond her comfort zone, Camille surveys, with a bit of uncertainty, her order. Black polenta with grilled octopus. She is afraid the octopus will taste like rubber bands, but it is delicious. Back in their apartment, she unwraps the shoes. Holding them up in each hand, she waves them about in dance steps. Cha-cha-cha! Everyone tries them on. Camille feels a twinge in her knee just looking at them. I'm going to lose 5 and get a black dress. I'm turning 70 in April. My work is burgeoning, she thinks. I'm taking a cue from Susan. More fitted clothes, brighter colors, and more rigor, like Julia. No more endless poring over art books. Work. She's done shopping for now. Late this afternoon and tomorrow morning, she has tickets to the Uffizi, where she plans to feast her eyes and fill her notebook. Susan takes off to explore artisan shops on the Oltrarno, the other side of the Arno. Having eaten too much, Julia announces that she needs a Renaissance nap. A letter to mail? My appointment is quick. Doctor smiling and pleased. Oh, sweet. Colin and I are in Florence overnight. We will dine with our American neighbors. They're all set up in a Riverview apartment Susan found. When she called, she said Camille has stepped far out of line, ordering octopus and shopping Prada. Her breakout in art has loosened other tethers. Not to mention the still unexplained sex on the sofa she toasted on our trip. As in Venice, they're all over town. Susan called from an uber-trendy cafe near the Pitti Palace that she spotted after leaving the Boboli Gardens. They were sitting outside drinking Campari sodas at 5 in the afternoon. We're meeting at 8, and I hope they're not wobbly. After my appointment, Colin still had work to do. The Palazzo restoration is stalled by the discovery of a fresco in a vast room slated to be divided into 3 rooms. The architect's nightmare. Now a pack of experts must evaluate the painting. At a glance, I'd say Colin is in for trouble. An entire wall looks to have ravishing depictions of Botticelli-like graces carrying a long flower chain toward the Virgin, who's reaching down for the blossoms as she ascends into the sky. Colin thinks to make that wall a long, wide hall, reducing the size he's planned for the bedrooms. I think they've just added a bundle of money to the property value. Architect Kit speaking, of course. I'm back in the hotel, thumbing through notes, organizing, and sometimes just gazing out at the Piazza Tornabuoni. Such a handsome space. I'm at a level view with 8 different styles of Renaissance windows. In moments like this, I'm close to Margaret, who fiercely loved architecture. We used to sit in the sun at Café Rivoire, overlooking Piazza della Signorina, ordering glasses of orange juice, talking about each building around that piazza that has seen everything from the burning of Savonarola to the installation of a brassy Jeff Koons statue next to the David, a copy. All the tourists in the world come there, but Margaret didn't notice. Look up, she'd admonish, or she'd look straight through them. Energy streamed out of Margaret. Just sitting there like anyone else, she had a force that even the waiter recognized. Solicitous, he was, instead of abrupt. In all the time I knew her, until she died at 75, she never changed an iota, except that her clothes became more eccentric. As I mentioned before, I thought she had a thing for Colin. She used to bring over a printout of a recent Renzo Piano or Zaha Hadid design and sit shoulder to shoulder with him, going over the specs and discussing whether the human element was subsumed to the design and how the light must play inside. I turn her manuscript to the end, where she has tucked in a letter. Addressed, stamped, but not sealed. Calhoun Green. A law office, Green, Green, and Schwartz in Richmond, Virginia. She obviously, it's yellowed, didn't mail it. Should I? Were the contents of the suitcase meant for me? She said she'd be back in the fall. After she returned to Washington, we heard less and less. And then nothing, and then everything. I read. Cal, this is Margaret Merrill writing you. I'm sure you remember well. After so many years, I want to tell you that your child did not get swabbed out and rinsed away. I gave birth to a boy, 8 pounds, a shock of black hair. Those blue eyes infants have that look like a deep summer night sky. Little fists he waved as though fighting the air. A solid little loaf of sugar. I was 21. I gave him up. Through an agency in New York, I selected a handsome naval architect who looked somewhat like you, but taller, and a musician who was rising rapidly in reputation. She wore her hair straight as a waterfall and had a lofty chin. I know they were good parents. During the process, I obtained their names, and then it was easy to locate their address on the Upper East Side. I was working in the city. I would go to a corner cafe near their brownstone. Polished brass numbers on the door, seasonal